The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach, the show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This week, global guru Bill Bierce returns to the show. He's going to reveal the secrets of global branding. How do you develop and cultivate your global footprint across various global business models and various brand management models? Bill, welcome back to Global Reach.
Hi, Tay. Thank you so much for having me on board.
Before we go on, I want to tell the audience a little bit about your background. Bill is the president and founder of Bierce & Kenderson PC, an award-winning business and technology law firm. He's been assisting innovative ventures, entrepreneurs, and global enterprises in achieving their business goals for over 30 years. He advises on all aspects of U.S. corporate law, including startups, alliances, mergers, acquisitions, and private equity investments, technology contracts, software licensing, regulatory issues, and business process management, also the management of human resources. Bill represents both U.S.-based businesses and many foreign-owned companies in their U.S. business operations, and he speaks French fluently. He's a prolific author in legal and regulatory issues and the publisher of the website outsourcing-law.com. He's also written the Devil's Dictionary humor book. Bill has been recognized by the U.S. Chamber and by Super Lawyers, by Chambers USA and Super Lawyers. He holds law degrees from New York University and the Université de Grenoble. So, again, welcome back to Global Reach.
Thank you, Tay.
And let's plunge right in. How do you create a brand management model that supports your business model?
That's a great question because the business model really drives what you're doing. And in a business model, you look at your value chains and your cash flow chains, what generates value for every aspect of your operation. Brand management is really a reflection of how you run your business as a strategic relationship through your entire business value chain. The value chain includes customers, but also your employees, your suppliers, anybody who's a service provider to you that supports your business, even can include your creditors, your investors, professional advisors, and, of course, regulators and your competitors. It's your entire ecosystem of trust and goodwill.
So your stakeholders.
Yes.
I like that, the ecosystem. Well, so there are different. We have different kinds of business models. How do you start linking a business model with a brand management model? Let's take a single entity, single product.
Well, that,
what do we do there?
The simplest. That's the simplest and easiest model.
Good way to start.
You define yourself, your own ecosystem. You just define your business targets, your target customers, and your clientele. Because what branding does is identifies the relationship between you and your clientele. So that's where trademarks come in because it's the source, it identifies the source of you as the producer and delivering party for their services and goods that your customers get. Single entity deal is basically you choose and you target that alone, and you're in charge of that brand management.
If I'm a brand new venture, and we have a lot of entrepreneurs in the audience, some new or nearly new ventures, how do I start cutting a serious brand swath in the marketplace?
Well, the first thing is you identify what you want to own. It turns out that the law permits you to own some real estate in branding. It's called your trademark. And also, to a certain extent, there's design you can do. But the trademark identifies your sourcing. So you need to identify those goods and services that you're producing, and you need to fit within some classes that are used by the various trademark treaties and trademark laws that allow you to say, okay, here's what I'm doing. And it's critical that you define the classes so that you fit within what your business model looks like. So if you're in services only, there's a class for advertising, for example, or for information technology consulting. But if you're making any goods or selling any goods under your own label or somebody else's label, and you want to add the products. So you have to look at the classes and then make a decision on how they fit.
So building on that, do you have any specific cases you're thinking of that you might be able to share with our listeners, something
well,
maybe
I have
really
a case
concrete?
I have a case right now where I have a foreign company that sells toys, games, and personal accessories for holiday and giftware. And they have about 14 classes that they can fit their products into, and they're worried about having to spend all this money on 14 classes for registration. And so what they need to think about is the fact that the trademark law protects not only the class that you're in, that you've got your registration for, but those adjacent classes where the same consumers go to the same channels of distribution, and when they buy one thing in one class, they're likely to buy the next thing similar to it in another class. So there's this doctrine of equivalency that is substantially equivalent, so the customer is going to say, oh, well, I'm going to go to buy from two or three classes. So you can save some money by not doing all 14 at the start, although you may want to go into them as you build your business.
Speaking of the new classes, you've got a strong brand. What kind of, you want to extend that brand. We'll see companies doing this all the time,
mm-hmm.
into new related or even unrelated goods and services. What kind of brand management model do you start to build then?
So
you're starting to, and you know, we've seen Google, we've seen Amazon, Bloomberg.
Well, this is a very exciting area of trademark and branding, because it allows you to take a Porsche brand or a Maserati brand, which people associate with a high-speed vehicle of sleek design, and then give it to someone who's going to design products for personal apparel, clothing, for household products, which you want to display perhaps to associate with the vehicle. So the extension of the brand is something which goes, you have to define not only the core brand and the model of the trust relationship that comes from the manufacturer of the automobile, but also that goes to the product, the goods that are associated with that. So like the driver might wear that kind of clothing. So it requires a link between the old, well-known, well-established brand and something new. And I'm not suggesting that we're going to have Heinz ketchup and then Heinz clothing for an extension.
Actually, M&M sells clothing. See it in Times Square. They have an M&M store.
Well, I got to go eat some then, right?
Yeah.
Buy it and eat it.
And, you know, we've just seen the soup can. from Andy Warhol, he's certainly popular, but I know what you mean. We're not going to see a Heinz ketchup car.
But it is the lateral thinking that really makes business the fun part of business, and why people buy, because they get spontaneous about something and say, oh, that's cool. I know Maserati from the races or from the movies. I like to have a Maserati something or other that I can stick in my house or wear around.
Yeah, I may not be able to afford the Maserati, but I want the image.
Yes.
When you talk about a manufacturer that's doing this in particular.
Pardon?
When you talk about a manufacturer like Maserati, that clothing or that, you know, snazzy appliance is really outside their core manufacturing competence. So you're talking about licensing.
Right.
How does Maserati protect its image and its brand when you have the unrelated company that's manufacturing it and it's an established company? I mean, if it's a complete outsource, you know, and the outside world won't see, you know, the manufacturer. But a lot of times, licensed clothing and things like that, you also have a second company.
So, I've done a lot of licensing with name brands. I don't want to mention them here, but licensing is a very, very classic way of allowing someone who's invested a lot in the brand to get people to invest themselves in design and manufacture and the full distribution chain, so that the brand licensor, all he has to do is sit back and wait for the check. And make sure that the brand is well managed. So the license agreement will basically identify the scope of the goods and services that are being licensed and can be manufactured under the license. It will set quality standards, because without quality standards, there is no trademark license, and it's just waste. It'll give auditing rights to check to see about sales are being covered and paid on license royalties are being collected and paid, and it'll give quality audit rights to see that if the products are shoddy, then it'll go, you can terminate the license. And for that reason, what will happen, the manufacturer, the licensee will have to give a run of like 25 or 50 samples of the product to the licensor to show that at the beginning of the new model, that these things have consistency and therefore can be sold in mass volumes.
Take another case. When you have a joint venture, two well-known companies are getting together. They're going to develop a third brand that may or may not be an amalgam of their names, but they've both got their own brands or brand families that are going to be associated with the output of the new company, the brands of the new company. What's the model of brand management that you use there?
Well,
a couple minutes to break, so
okay.
The go
gold,
into that and then go to break.
The standard on that, I think, is Dow Corning, which has been a joint venture between Dow Chemical and Corning for 30, 40 years. And they basically have identified that they're going to be only in a certain target market, and they each has the value, and so the goodwill of each joint venture partner is used, and they use the same names. They combine the names. That's the short answer. But together, they have to jointly decide on how it works.
And are there any particular considerations, money, infrastructure, that you need to look at in terms of the branding?
The most important thing for branding, co-branding with someone else, is having a common business plan. Alignment of interests, alignment of business opportunity, targeting the right clientele, and executing so that each party feels that they can trust each other as partners, and that the customers therefore can trust them as a joint unit supplying them without worrying about behind-the-scenes political fights and management fights, if any.
I have a client, I won't say who, but they're in a joint venture with another equal-sized major chemical company, and the alliance partner, JV partner, just keeps going off on incredible tangents, and it's caused all kinds of problems. But on that note, We're going to go to break. When we get back, I want to talk about a little bit beyond a 50-50 JV, and voting on that can be really tricky. You know, what do you think about the broader strategic alliance, where two companies are getting together for marketing or for manufacturing? It may not quite be a joint venture, but we'll do that when we get back, and then we're going to talk about basically protecting your brand across borders, across jurisdictions, and the different formats you need to use. Don't go away.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to our second section. I'm here with Bill Bierce, and we are talking about how do you match your brand management model with your global business model. And we're just about to get into the subject of strategic alliances, one of my favorite topics. Some years ago, I actually edited and researched a book on cross-border, what we called competitive alliances, because a lot of people were teaming up with their competitors. So it's a different model. What do you have to think about when it's an alliance like that?
Well, actually, the alliance has to have the credibility for the customer base. And what we're seeing is a lot of American companies might be teaming up with foreign companies because the foreign companies might be providing a certain kind of back office or back channel services or production. Let me give you an example of what happened recently. Computer Sciences Corporation, which is a big international information technology management company and consulting company, decided essentially that it was going to be assigning to an Indian partner, HCL, the function of running data centers, because data centers require a lot of personnel. And you can do that more effectively, perhaps, in India than you can in the United States based upon cost management. And HCL, the problem with outsourcing or running the thing offshore yourself is you have to manage the people and you have to manage the whole delivery service delivery model. So what in this situation, CSC is saying, we will continue to support our customers. We will maintain the customer account responsibility. We will identify what the customer needs, and we'll deliver it, and we'll respond to their requirements. And HCL is basically going to help us perform, and we will supervise them as our subcontractor. And that's a way, perhaps, of exiting a business, but it's also a way of assuring clients that given your cost, a high-cost model of a current American-based data center, that you'll continue to provide the services for a long time, and you have teamed up with someone. So you're not going to walk away, and therefore you're creating the trust with your customer.
So that's the brand management side? Because I see this as the business model. What I'm not making the connection is, how does that relate to the brand management model?
Well, the brand management is, we have selected, the concept of brand management is, we, CSC, have developed goodwill with you, and you know and can rely upon us. You can trust us for delivering. We have a corporate culture of making sure that our customers are satisfied with great user experience. We deliver value, and we have an ecosystem of trusted relationships across the supply chain and the customers. So the brand management concept is, we will continue to have the same customers, and we will provide you with the best that can be that's available, and we give you some flexibility. We can do it in the U.S., we can do it in other places, and therefore we've got global footprint and giving you a better choice. So rely on us.
So really you're talking about trust, and the brand management is to maintain trust in your brand even though you're outsourcing a lot of function.
Well, yes, and the funny thing about trust is the flip side is something called reputational risk. And if you rely on somebody to do work for you that you have no, you're not controlling, you outsource something, then obviously you're responsible for their non-performance. So when you do rely upon trusted suppliers, as in anything in supply chain management, you need to manage your reputational risk that they will deliver, and there are ways you can do that risk mitigation, which is a whole other story.
Let me go back again to the whole issue of trust, which links to goodwill.
Goodwill and reliability. It's basically reliability, quality, predictability, and ease of dealing business. You know what you're going to get. It's predictability.
When we were talking before the show, you raised another way to brand, which I thought was really interesting, which was branding through a third party, have a trusted third party like a trade association or a conference. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We all always think about branding as being just our trademark, but actually I sort of would like to suggest an idea of rent a trademark or use somebody else's influence and finding an influencer in the industry as a gatekeeper or as a value benchmark for what you're doing. So if you can get yourself associated with a university or a trade organization or an event planner, you can effectively rent the goodwill. You may have to pay to play, to give a speech, but effectively you get in front of the audience you're after, and you're demonstrated as an expert in the business. And I see this all the time, and basically the way you do it is you rent a booth, you give a speech, you hand out materials, you do follow-ups, and it's the full sales cycle, and you're doing it on rented goodwill.
I love that. We've been talking a lot about the basics, trademark, and some of the other ways of protecting a brand, but can you take us through the ways we protect our brand in multiple jurisdiction?
Sure. In America, we basically, it's funny, the trademark, patent, and copyright laws are all based on national law. And in 1886, the Paris Convention adopted some rules on multinational respect for the intellectual property of other countries so that there wouldn't be this hodgepodge. So they've adopted some basic rules. And on the trademarks, you have classifications that you need to fit in with under the Nice Convention, and those are multinational. The Madrid Convention allows you to do a filing in one country and get a priority for the use of that mark as to timing, of first use in that country. So you have the right to set up a program, and generally you want to do your program within the year of you're starting to do your operations, because you lose your priority after the first year if you file in one jurisdiction and don't file within the next.
So what doesn't a trademark protect? I've always thought, you know, the patent protection is stronger than trademark. So I'm never clear what trademark does and does not protect.
Okay, so it's really very simple. Trademark is the identifier of the source or origin of goods or services. They're the brand. And for an individual mark, it comes from who is manufacturing or delivering the service. You can have a certification mark, which is like the International Standards Organization or Underwriters Laboratories, and they give you a mark that they license to you, saying you've met our standards, and therefore you can use our brand. And that's also another way of renting a brand. And then a collective mark is where multiple organizations share ownership of the same brand. Collective brand, if you look at KPMG or Ernst & Young, people like that, they may have a Swiss Verein, which would own the name and then license it to every other separate entity in the world. And so multilaterally, they have separate trademarks and they get licenses. So the trademark represents the source. The copyright represents the expression of the idea of originality of work of authorship. And a trade secret is a concept or method of business that's not generally public. Some other people may know it, but they don't publish it. And it gives you a competitive advantage. And so long as it's secret, it'll continue to give you a competitive advantage.
Probably the most famous trade secret of all time is the formula for Coca-Cola.
If you've been to Atlanta, you know that they worry about where it's located, too. They've moved it around recently to their own premises.
So, there are a couple of other marks, state marks and federal marks, and I don't quite understand what the difference is.
Oh, that's great. Great question, because the United States, being a federal system, offers two parallel systems of trademarks. The federal trademarks cover the entire country and are based upon the right of Congress under the exclusive right of Congress under the Constitution to regulate trade between the states and foreign countries. However, I've had situations where we've been fighting with someone else who's already got a mark, federal mark, and so we go to the state and say, look to the maybe 5 or 10 states where we have our clients have specific outlets and sell to maybe department stores or to specific targets, and we get a state registration, which is valid only in the state. And the conflict between the state and the federal mark is really no conflict at all, because it's a question of who's got jurisdiction. And you have the right to protect your state mark only in that state, but you're protected within that state. But if you're doing trade from that state to another state, then the federal mark is the one that protects you on that cross interstate commerce.
So if I'm a foreign company coming into the U.S., does that mean that I not only need to get my trademark established in the U.S., but I need to get it established in every state as well?
Yes,
I'm serious.
No. Well, you do that by getting the federal mark. You can do that by getting the federal mark, because that effectively says you're selling from a foreign country to that state. And that meets the test of interstate and international commerce governed by by the Commerce Clause. But you don't need to do the state registration. State registration is really sort of an antiquity, but it's something which we've used, sophisticated people use when they're stuck and they can't get around somebody else's really federal mark. But then you have the other issue is it doesn't necessarily protect you from a prior federal mark. So you do need you will at some point get into conflict. The best solution is to do the federal mark right away.
We've actually run out of time in this segment. I want to continue this when we get back because I want to turn it around and said instead of an international company coming into the U.S., a U.S. company going abroad and or moving international from any other base, how do you protect your trademark in every country or everywhere you want to sell? But we're going to do that in the next segment.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking about the secrets of global branding, and certainly one of the secrets is how do you best protect your brand, your trademark, in other jurisdictions. I'm going overseas. I'm based in the UK. I'm based in Mexico. I'm based in the U.S. How many jurisdictions do I really need to establish my trademark in? And then once we go through that, how do I protect my trademark in China?
Well, this is a great question. It really gets to the use of trademarks both when you're selling in the United States and when you're selling abroad. I've had a situation when I was representing a licensor of clothing, and they were negotiating with a Taiwanese manufacturer for manufacturing the entire production line. And we discovered after the client had already been talking to the manufacturer before I got involved, but we discovered that the manufacturer had already applied for a registration of the mark in Taiwan so that any goods manufactured there would be subject to their right to let it go, let it be sold. I've had another, so we had to pay off that, we had to litigate or pay off. And I've had another situation where American seller manufactures in China under subcontract, and there was a problem in China because someone else had gotten the mark or a similar mark that that effectively prevented them from exporting from China. So the Chinese mark protects the manufacturer and prevents the American owner of the mark from exporting Chinese-made goods. So that's not a really good solution. So the first thing you want to do is you want to look to the countries where you manufacture your goods and decide that you're going to register there because you don't want your manufacturers acting in competition with you, and they could even flood the local market if they wanted to. And then you get gray market imports, and you're in trouble. So it's very, very important to know your critical supply countries from wherever source. And then the other issue is going off to where your target customers are. You need to have a program of where you want to sell, where you think you're going to make the money, because you have issues of gray market and black market, just gray market goods, which are validly licensed and made goods that are being sold without any benefit to the, to you.
Sold in territories they're not supposed to be selling them in.
Right. I mean, I think the textbook manufacturers in college books have figured out in copyright issues. There was a different story because there's a manufacturing clause. You have to make it in the United States. That was abandoned a while ago. So if you're going to be licensing to manufacture in Thailand, you may collect a lot less revenue there because you don't own the trademark, the copyright there. This is one case where copyright comes in. It's not just trademark. So you got to go to each market and think about how you're going to be selling in each market, what your plan is, so that you don't create an industry that's full of excess capacity that could come back to your core market. Although you do have what's good about your U.S. trademark is that when you sell offshore, you're worried about having your offshore customers who maybe have paid a little bit less price because you may have a difference in price for the offshore market, taking those goods and selling them back to the United States. And the United States actually has some Customs and Border Patrol, which allows you to prevent trademark goods from coming in without your authorization.
Kind of tell, for example, when you buy a package of batteries and the back of it has another language.
Don't you speak the language?
But you maybe get the idea that it might have been manufactured for sale elsewhere?
Well, we yes, that's okay. Those of us who've lived in Europe regularly look at packaging with six or seven languages. And in North America, we see two or three languages. So I think that's what they're doing is they're getting economies of scale by having single packaging for the same goods, which actually improves the brand because you know that if it's good enough for sale in the United States, it could be good enough for sale in Canada or Mexico.
I was rather thinking of the peddler on the street who is selling Ever-Ready batteries where the entire label is in Chinese. But basically, from what I get from you, is you really have to establish your trademark protection and your copyright protection pretty broadly internationally. How do you manage the costs on that, particularly if you're a smaller company? And we have a lot of smaller companies going international now. I mean,
well,
a large company, they've got divisions around the world, they've got the law firms, but what about the small and medium-sized company?
It's really the small company has a very difficult problem. And actually, sometimes what they do is they substitute getting a URL instead of getting a trademark. The trademark, you have to pay several hundred dollars for, maybe $1,000 or more per country, per class, per mark. And that adds up. So when you're doing a URL, what you do is you get the URL, and the URL, which could be .fr, .uk, .co, or whatever it is, .au, and you get that, which is very cheap. But you have to keep in mind that under the rules of the ICANN, which is the governance body for URLs, trademark always takes precedence over a URL. So you do need to make sure that your URL is protected. So now what you do is you trademark first in core countries, and then you get your URL, which is the same. And so you can protect in those countries, but then you're exposed to the countries that you're not trademarked in. That's the issue.
Interesting. It's a very tricky business. Let's switch. Does the when you try to match your brand to a brand management model, does it matter, you know, where you get your funding from? I'm not thinking about publicly held companies, but I'm really thinking about, again, the entrepreneurs, the smaller companies, newly acquired companies. You know, does it matter the source of the funding in terms of brand management?
Well, it's funny you ask that question. If you've ever had a good discussion with a venture capitalist, he or she will tell you that the most important thing they want to see is this product or service will have legs and will withstand competition from others. And so they're looking at intellectual property, and they want to see a patent application. They want to see a trademark profile, and they want to see that the name is something that will, the trademark brand is something which will really sell and has got sex in it. They're not looking for something tired. They were looking for something that they will invest in, because they know that they're going to have to put some of their money into the brand. And if you've already gotten like 5 or 10 core registrations for a good brand, great. But if the brand that you've selected is something which is sleepy and ho-hum, then that's a negative, and it suggests that you've got bad selection of management talent.
Hmm.
And you're not a good candidate for investing.
Interesting. One kind of business model we didn't talk about that I always thought was really interesting is kind of the roll-up. What happens when you're rolling up different brands under a single umbrella? How do you create a model for those different brands?
Well, there are two types of roll-ups I'd like to talk about. One is where a group of individual companies combine together under a common mark that they own. And the other is where separate companies who are in the same business but have different marks combine under a new holding company. The first situation is very interesting, and I've done this a couple of times, and it's been very productive and very profitable, is where you have maybe 35 cities in the United States. Each has a small company that's doing something that's really unique and local. Could be real estate brokerage. It could be value-added reseller for IT. It could be anything that requires a physical presence. Could be, you know, household stuff. And so you've got this. What they do is you first create a holding company, and everybody in the 35 group owns a small share. And then that company applies for the federal mark, and then it licenses that mark to each of the 35. So now everybody's working for household something or other, and everybody recognizes that brand because that's being marketed in 35 cities. That's a great deal, and I did one of those where we sold a whole 35 cities to a company that wanted everybody, and for a couple $100 million. We thought that was a great exit strategy. It worked. You plan it for 10 years, and it gives everybody a chance to really integrate, to work together. You create the synergy during your plan. There are phases to it. So it's a real business roll-up model. It's self-sustaining, and during that term, you retain ownership of your own operation, and that was cool.
So could you do something similar in the European Union? Take companies and small companies and similar businesses, you know, in the different EU member states,
mm-hmm.
and do that.
There's nothing exactly that. That's a great model both in the EU and anywhere else. You could, frankly, now everybody's global. You're going to want to do it on 6 continents. 7, I think, is Antarctica.
Not sure we have a lot of businesses there yet. So. And we are planning, actually, a 6-continent venture soon. Does the EU have the same? Can you get an EU trademark, EU copyright, or
right? Well, the EU copyright issues are separate. Basically, they don't require you to deposit a copy with a local registrar, unlike the United States, which does. EU trademarks have a European mark where you have a base country, say you set one, and then you extend that mark to other countries by extension. So you can file one application, and then by treaty, the other countries are covered. But the risk with the EU mark is a little bit different than if you applied separately for each country. If the core mark in the first country fails because of some glitch, such as someone else claims that it's infringing, and it gets bounced, then everything else falls. So that's the foundation upon which you build your structure. So make sure that your core country is strong, and then you're good because it facilitates and expedites your filing program.
We just got a minute. Very interesting stuff. We just got a minute to break, though, and there is a interesting type of business model that you raised when we were talking in the break. Cohabitation. We don't have time to go into a lot, but just briefly, before we go to break, how do you define the business model of cohabitation?
Cohabitation is where you're working together under the same mark, and you're not necessarily in the same business, or you're trying to, you're basically extending the marks to your products and their products, and you have to decide down the road how you're going to end up with an exit plan.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about how do you handle conflicts that are inevitable in any form of cohabitation, and then the unique challenges that you face when you're doing online branding. So don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back, everyone. This is Tay Revez, and I'm here with global legal guru Bill Bierce, and we're talking about cohabitating companies, two companies occupying the same brand. So conflicts are inevitable. How do you deal with them?
Well, we were talking earlier about the roll-up situation where everybody owns a common brand through a holding company that they've owned, and it's the same thing as with the big four accounting firms that they have, that Swiss Verein, where they basically license their trademark to themselves. And it's a self-franchising, collective branding deal. That's your cohabitation. So effectively, when you co-own anything, first thing you do is you do a prenup. And a prenuptial agreement is basically a shareholders agreement or licensing agreement under which everybody identifies what their voting rights are and what their alignment is, what their expectations are. Is in a sense Let me give you an example of the case where three operating companies in three different countries create a new holding company, and they contribute the shares of the U.S. and foreign companies to the holding company. And effectively, everybody becomes a subsidiary of the holding company. So then, instead of running their own board of directors, they have to run the board of directors of the holding company. So they don't get the same amount of control. And the way they solve the conflict issues is they have shareholder democracy at the board level of the holding company, and they define what they're going to do, the missions. One key issue in any prenup is what I call the expulsion clause, where somebody who's not doing something according to the mission statement winds up getting expelled. And somebody who was, and that's for the benefit of the sustainability of the organism, and I call that, in some cases, it's like a white blood cell coming in and cleaning house. But effectively, it's through negotiation and structuring to the common mission. And then the common mission also should include an exit plan so that if you're in disagreement, you have either a buyout of one party by the other or a sale to a third party. So it's strategic planning so you don't lose the value that you've created together.
So really, I think that's a very tricky field, and one needs an expert like you to pilot a company through it. I don't think that's DIY stuff. So, speaking of DIY, because some of us do create our own websites, but we mentioned URLs and branding. What are some of the unique challenges that we can face when we're doing online branding and online brand management?
Well, I think everybody's, the thing about the internet and social media, mobile apps, and data analytics is that there's a huge amount of data that's being produced, and you can create waves of data, and mobile branding is, and social media branding is very cool because it's viral and has such a great ability to extend. It also has the negative that it's universally accessible if someone wants to badmouth your brand or come up with a YouTube. So effectively, this tool that we now use to create value is also a tool for harassment, denigration, and conflict. So effectively, a whole new industry has come up. People who monitor your website, Google you, self-protection to see what's going on, look at Twitter, and actually it's not so bad because once you've done that, you've identified customer dissatisfaction. You then aren't able to spot the individuals or the issues that are creating that customer experience and remedy the situation quickly. And it's the failure to remedy which can impair your brand. So effectively, you can make it or break it, and you need to manage it.
So if I'm a big company, I have a department that can do that. And if I'm a small company?
If you're a small company, just Google yourself for a little while. Once every day, Google yourself once a day.
Google yourself once a day. Interesting. Are there other issues? We've got about 3 minutes left to close now. It goes so fast. What about issues like your design patent issues? Are there related copyright issues we really need to think about?
Well, intellectual property is a bundle, and everything works interchangeably. It works as a puzzle. So the design can be part of the designs can be patented just as a pure design, but not as a functional operation. Copyright only protects the expression of the idea, but not the idea itself. So you need to keep trade secrets, copyrights, and basically you want to take critical factors. You don't want to disclose your trade secrets. You might hint at them in your branding, but you don't tell everybody how you work. And then another thing I'd like to focus on in terms of the closing issues.
Okay, because we've got 1 minute.
Okay, reputational risk. risk management, business continuity planning. They're all related. And effectively, if you're out of business because of some force majeure or supplier not failure or something that causes you to have a bad relationship with your customers or your suppliers, that's a reputational risk which could impair the sustainability of your organization. So brand management is not an option. It's something you have to do, and it's something you need to plan for both operationally and from the standpoint of marketing and sales, service delivery, and overall supervisory management.
It's a big plateful. And are there any organizations that can help a small company do that? So I can concentrate on the main part of my business?
There are individual companies that will monitor trademarks to see whether they're infringing. You can tell them, here's my mark, and I go take a look, see if there's anything similar being filed. But you need, it's a selective thing.
Okay.
Effectively, you'd have to get, the best thing to do is hire somebody who will do that for you or on a part-time basis.
Bill, this has just been jam-full of information and really valuable information. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Tay.
Next week, we've got Richard Rubito from the Overseas Development and Finance Group, London, Paris, and he's going to talk about the difference in entrepreneurial cultures between France and the U.S. So I hope you'll come back next week. Meanwhile, on behalf of Bill Bierce and myself, we wish you great success in the coming week in extending your global reach. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.